Off the Ball.
In association with Air. Don't miss live and exclusive Premier League action this month on the Air Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
So the football show on the way will include Raphael Honigstein talking about Jupp Heynckes, who has really turned things around at Bayern Munich. They were 5-0 winners against Besiktas last night after seemingly looking lost for much of the season under Ancelotti. And then we will get the full time from Andy West, full time thoughts from Andy West on this game in Seville, where it's still nil all. To something completely different. Regular listeners to the show will, I'm sure, have figured out that we don't subscribe to that whole sport and politics don't mix business. They have done, they do, and will continue to. The current Winter Olympics struck us as a case in point. The LGBT community have been very much to the fore. We've seen Eric Radford making history as the Games' first openly gay gold medalist. And then at the opening ceremony, all eyes last week were on the US Vice President Mike Pence and his wife, who were sitting in the same box as Kim Jong-un's sister and also the head of state, Kim Jong-nam. There was no eye contact, there were no handshakes, and everybody looked on to see would there be. The White House confirmed this week that there had been secret talks planned for the day after that opening ceremony, which North Korea then cancelled at the very last minute. So all very dramatic, and maybe once again echoes of ping pong diplomacy, where sport is very much used in these geopolitical affairs. So we wanted to talk a bit more about where ping pong diplomacy has come from. And we were joined earlier on by Nicholas Griffin. He's the author of Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret Behind the Game That Changed the World. And we welcomed him earlier on to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
If you don't mind, I'm going to let Forrest Gump give us the unscientific version of what happened back in the 1970s.
I thought I was going back to Vietnam, but instead they decided the best way for me to fight the communists was to play ping pong. So I was in the special services, traveling around the country, cheering up all them wounded veterans and showing them how to play ping pong. I was so good that some years later, the Army decided that I should be on the All-America ping pong team. We were the first Americans to visit the land of China in like a million years or something like that. Somebody said world peace was in our hands. But all I did was play ping pong.
So that pretty much covers it, I guess.
Yeah, I think we can leave it at that.
So people who may have no idea, and I think most of our listeners will, to be honest, but ping pong diplomacy, I know it originates a long time before the 70s and your book covers that. But for the purposes of this conversation, it was that visit in 1971 of the US team to China where I suppose it really nailed itself down in popular culture. This was a US team which visited China in 1971. What happened the following year was a Chinese team visited the US, and this all paved the way for Nixon to visit China. And this was the first time, to use Tom Hanks's phrase, in about a billion years this had happened, or certainly in 20 years anyway.
That's right. Yeah, no, this was considered, you know, the first crack in the opening between China and the US. Nixon, of course, called it his opening to China. But you know, what I found out as I dug around, that it was more the other way around, that it was China's opening to the US.
Let's talk about the political context then before we get into the specifics of this US team who went to China. I mean, I read, and you can put me wrong here, so that's interesting. You're mentioning the Chinese were keen maybe to engage with the Americans, because Nixon, certainly from the reading I was doing, by this stage was desperate to end the Vietnam War. He had a US election, a presidential election on the horizon. The Russians weren't exactly playing the peacemaker. And China, I know you wrote in your book, were the only other big influence in Vietnam, in Hanoi. This was the Nixon side of things. Where were China?
China were, you know, from a Western perspective, we'd always thought of communism as this sort of great monolith, but that wasn't true by the time the 70s rolled around. So there was an awful lot of antagonism between the Soviets and Mao and China. And it had really got to a terrifically antagonistic point where if there was going to be any nuclear breakpoint in the world at that point, it was actually within the communist bloc. Mm. So there was all sorts of border skirmishes going on between China and Russia. So that was a relationship that Mao was quite ready to jettison. And, you know, his big idea was to reach all the way across to America.
I understand there were secret talks ongoing before the world table tennis championships in Japan. They happened in 1971. There had been diplomatic channels opened.
Yeah, there had been. They were very low level. They went on in Poland, and I think Kissinger said that their most significant achievement was that I think there had been almost 100 of them, and they'd achieved exactly nothing. Mm. So those talks meant nothing. But a second channel that really was secret had been opened through Pakistan, where Zhou Enlai, Mao's number two, and Kissinger, who was very much acting as Nixon's number two, were in contact. But then that conversation went cold. So how to reinvigorate it?
Okay, which brings us to Japan, 1971. The 31st World Table Tennis Championships are on that April. You might talk to us about the 19-year-old US player Glenn Cohen and his first interaction with the Chinese team. That seems like the most celebrated moment.
Yeah. And even to this day, people still talk about it as this marvelous, happy coincidence where Cowan sort of bumps into the head of the Chinese team and that this friendship somehow begins. But that's really not how it happened at all.
Okay.
And it was a very deliberate meeting executed entirely by the Chinese. And Cowan was more like a sort of patsy in a con game than the architect of this sort of spontaneous moment.
Because the popular myth is that Cowan was stuck for a lift or had missed the team bus after practice one day and inadvertently or else was beckoned over, hopped on to the Chinese team bus. And Zhuang, the best player you mentioned there, it gave him a gift and Cowan gave him a gift in return. And the photographers just happened to be on the scene to capture this massively politically charged moment of fun and love and everybody's happy. So it seems like it was all more choreographed than that. Cowan, the 19-year-old US player, based on what you're saying, didn't know a whole lot about what was going on here. Was he beckoned onto the Chinese bus? Did that happen?
Yeah, that did happen. The bus was waiting for him. And when he comes out, he's waved over and he's waved onto the bus.
Okay.
And I think they knew what they were doing. They had approached Cowan the day before and he seemed, of course he seemed interested in the Chinese. They were the best in the world by a country mile. And, you know, he played the same sport they did. And, you know, it would rather be like being a sort of a non-league footballer and, you know, being invited straight into Wembley Stadium. You're gonna go. Mm. So he was intrigued.
What present did they give him?
They gave him a silk screen tapestry of some mountains in China. And he, in return, had to go shopping in Japan and find a Let It Be peace, pro-peace T-shirt, which seemed vaguely appropriate.
Yeah, not exactly subtle, but vaguely appropriate. And were photographers there to capture the moment?
Yeah. And Cowan was very much pro press. You know, he thought of this immediately as a sort of golden opportunity to become something other than just a ping pong player. And, you know, for a while, he was just about the most famous man in America. Didn't last very long, but it did happen.
And did this picture do the rounds? Was this front page news?
Oh, it was front page news in pretty much every country in the world. I think everyone immediately recognized that it was a huge deal for you know, capitalist America and communist China to have any kind of linkage whatsoever, because they didn't. There was no embassy, there were no diplomats in either country, and there was a total seeming lack of understanding between those two cultures.
Yeah, I mean the 20 years post the Korean War, where I suppose relations soured desperately. Those 20 years, there'd been no diplomatic relations whatsoever, aside from those secret talks you mentioned, which didn't lead to a whole lot. And there was just a huge amount of propaganda and scaremongering and misunderstanding on both sides.
Yeah, no, there's a wonderful moment early when the Americans do finally get to China, where one of the American athletes asks one of the Chinese handlers if this is the first time he's ever seen an American, and he goes, no, I saw one on the battlefield in the Korean War.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And what kind of character was Cowan then? He sounds like just exactly the right type to have been caught up in this situation, which makes me wonder if the Chinese had done some kind of due diligence and targeted him as the best guy to approach.
I think they had. They'd kept an eye on him only in practice. He was a free spirit, but his father had worked in public relations. I think he knew what PR was, and I think his teammates had a sort of varied opinions of him. They thought maybe he was a bit too manipulative and maybe a little bit too happy to play the lead role.
Okay.
Uh, but somebody had to, and he said, you know, to have a hippie in capital in communist China was certainly a striking image.
So China decide then to extend an invitation to the US team to visit China. President Nixon wrote in his memoirs, "I was surprised as I was pleased. I had never expected that the China initiative would come to fruition in the form of a ping pong team." That's genuine, is it? I mean, based on what you're saying, it sounds like it could well be that the US were slightly taken aback at all this.
I think they were. They certainly didn't think it could happen through ping pong. But I think that's sort of the brilliance of Mao and Zhou Enlai, was that they'd realized that it's something the Chinese could approach from probably the only thing they were better than America at in 1971 was ping pong. So it gave them this sort of a benevolence, you know, that they were doing the Americans a favor by inviting them and having these extravagant exhibition games in front of 25,000 people. And they could do it from a position of strength.
So the US spent 10 days traveling around China playing these exhibition games. I saw a quote from Tim Boggan saying, "Everything was different from anything I'd ever seen," he told the New York Times. "The streets were different, the food was different, the people, of course, were different, the bicycles were different." And the US players, it seems, they were treated effectively like visiting dignitaries, and they were lavished with banquets and meals, and this was the tone of the trip. The press were there for these 10 days that the US team spent in China.
Yeah, that was another surprise. It didn't seem like it was going to happen at the beginning, but then suddenly some very key correspondents were invited in with the team, and the cameras rolled and the footage shot around the world immediately, and it really was striking. You know, Glenn Cowan wandered around wearing purple bell-bottoms. Everyone in China was pretty much wearing the same thing at that point. So the images really are wonderful. But this even included inviting the ping pong team into Zhou Enlai's private rooms, where he had a reception with them. I mean, it was very hard to imagine something like that happening. I mean, imagine a curling team from China being invited straight into the Rose Garden at the White House. Seems preposterous.
And was the atmosphere on the trip relaxed? Because in some senses, it strikes me as quite a pressurized environment. You can almost imagine a word coming from the US to this 10-man team: don't screw this up. Don't say the wrong thing at the wrong time.
Yeah, I mean, there was some of that, but actually, it was the opposite had sort of happened, where the US government and the administration decided to step away from it and sort of leave it be, and to insist that it really wasn't political. And yet, of course, what could be more political?
Yeah.
But, you know, the Americans had no idea. The American administration had no idea who the team members were who were going in there. So they were worried that somehow everything could get screwed up. And, of course, there were some pretty colorful characters and very representative characters. And if you look at that American ping pong team, it had everything in it. You know, all races were represented. There were, you know, teenage girls. There were 40-year-old men. I mean, it was truly an American group.
Mm. So they went directly from Japan, from the World Championships, to China. So there wasn't that time for the U.S. administration really to school them or interfere with them too much.
No, not at all. And okay. Perhaps it was a sensible thing to do. They stepped away.
If you jump ahead to 1972, and I can imagine, again, this is front page news everywhere, this trip, and everybody understands the significance of it. A Chinese table tennis team turn up then in the US. They do an 8-city tour, and 1972 culminates then in Nixon visiting China, a state visit to China.
That's right. And it was, you know, once again to have, you know, Chinese communist athletes wandering around, you know, famous American tourist spots was disconcerting, and yet, of course, highly entertaining for the press and the people. So it gets an awful lot of coverage, but nothing like the coverage that Nixon gets when he goes to China. I think those numbers are extraordinary. I think it's at that point, and it was the second most watched event in American history behind the lunar landings.
Because Nixon calls that his own 8-day trip later on the week that changed the world, not to put too, you know, grandiose a thing in it from his perspective. I guess it suits his standing in world politics to classify it like that. But I mean, I didn't realize it was the second most watched event on US television at that point.
Yeah, no, it was a huge deal. And, you know, the thing about China was all the American ideas about what China was had all been formed decades before. So, you know, one China watcher described American understanding of China in that 20 years where no one was allowed in as more like astrophysics than diplomacy. You just had no idea what was going on in there. So to get this suddenly in color live on your television screens was an extraordinary insight into what had previously been a black hole.
Nixon also later wrote that the Chinese leaders, he says, took particular delight in reminding me that an exchange of ping pong teams had initiated a breakthrough in our relations.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the genius of it, was that it all seemed so harmless.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think what we thought of one another, you know, the Americans were sort of the running dogs of capitalism, and for the West, the Chinese were these sort of red ants who had no personality whatsoever. And ping pong was one of the few things where you could all just realize that it somehow seems sort of rather benevolent or at least not so serious. And I think it had this tremendous effect before Nixon's trip, where it softened up both populations. And for Nixon to have done that coming from the hard right, and for Mao to have done that coming from the hard left, was just real brinksmanship.
And how were relations in those immediate years afterwards then? Obviously, you know, the world's a complicated place and Mao doesn't live for much longer after that. I think 76 is his death off the top of my head. So, I mean, I presume it's baby steps even after the Nixon visit, or where do things go?
Yeah, relatively speaking, it's baby steps, you know, and you don't get the establishment of proper relations until the Carter administration. But you know, all the hard work is done in those opening months. And, you know, I think when you put it in context, I think the relations between the U.S. and China move at an extraordinary speed. I mean, I think now it's very obvious that it's perhaps the key relationship in the world. But I think even then, Kissinger and Zhou Enlai were thinking that already in 1971.
And did anything of interest become of any of the U.S. table tennis team?
Well, they certainly had this burst of glory when they all came back. I mean, Cowan's story is the most well-known and rather a sad one, because he thinks it's going to last forever and that he's going to become this sort of a big celebrity, and he's going to raise ping pong to sort of baseball-like stature in the U.S. and going to make a fortune while he's doing it. And of course, really what it is was the ultimate 15 minutes of fame. And unfortunately, that leads to, I think, a mental instability. He ends up pretty much homeless on the streets of Los Angeles and dies at a very young age. And, you know, was he already slightly unstable before this started? I don't know. But certainly this was a high pressure that led to high expectations and maybe deep disappointments for him.
Wow. Fascinating. I didn't realize that's a sad note to end on. But Nicholas Griffin, author of Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World. Thanks so much for filling us in on all that, Nicholas.
Thanks so much.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.